The entire Aral Sea is now essentially gone. The parable of the Aral Sea has a simple message. Mistakes in our dealings with Mother Nature can now have much larger unintended consequences, because many of our new technologies confer upon us new power without automatically giving us new wisdom. In Ferrybridge, England, a coal-fired power station dwarfs the homes below it, virtually blocking out the sky. One illustration of how some of our new technologies overwhelm the human scale. Our new technologies, combined with our numbers, have made us, collectively, a force of nature.
And those with the most technology have the greatest moral obligation to use it wisely. And this, too, is a political issue. Policy matters. The United States is responsible for more greenhouse gas pollution than South America, Africa, the Middle East, Australia, Japan, and Asia, all put together. If you compare the per capita carbon emissions in China, India, Africa, Japan, the European Union, and Russia to those in the United States, you'll see that we are way, way above everyone else, roughly double those of Russia, which is in second place. Of course, population size must be factored into the calculation, and when it is, China's role is seen as a larger and growing factor. The same is true of Europe, but the United States is still far above the others. The third and final factor causing the collision between humankind and nature is both the subtlest and most important: our fundamental way of thinking about the climate crisis. And the first problem in the way we think about the climate crisis is that it seems easier not to think about it at all. One reason it doesn't consistently demand our attention can be illustrated by the classic story about an old science experiment involving a frog that jumps into a pot of boiling water and immediately jumps out again because it instantly recognizes the danger. The same frog, finding itself in a pot of lukewarm water that is being slowly brought to a boil, will simply stay in the water, in spite of the danger, until it is rescued. Al Gore used to recount the story about the frog with a different ending to that last sentence. He used to say, "until the frog is boiled." But after dozens of slideshows were followed by at least one anguished listener coming up to him and expressing concern for the fate of the frog, Gore finally learned the importance of rescuing the frog. But of course, the larger point of the story is that our collective nervous system, through which we recognize an impending danger to our survival, is similar to the frog's. If we experience a significant change in our circumstances gradually and slowly, we are capable of sitting still and failing to recognize the seriousness of what is happening to us until it's too late. Sometimes, like the frog, we only react to a sudden jolt, a dramatic and speedy change in our circumstances that sets off our alarm bells. Global warming may seem gradual in the context of a single lifetime, but in the context of the Earth's history, it is actually happening with lightning speed. Its pace is now accelerating so rapidly that even in our own lifetimes, we are beginning to see the telltale bubbles of a boiling pot. We are, of course, also different from the frog. We don't have to wait for the boiling pot in order to understand the danger we are in, and we do have the ability to rescue ourselves. As Mark Twain famously pointed out, denial ain't just a river in Egypt.
When acid rain was falling on parts of the United States, particularly in the Northeast, back in the 1980s, an innovative program helped to clean up the polluted precipitation. With bipartisan support, the Congress put in place a system for buying and selling emissions of sulfur dioxide, the main culprit behind acid rain. Called a cap-and-trade system, it used the power of market forces to help drastically reduce sulfur dioxide emissions while allowing pioneering companies to profit from environmental stewardship. A similar approach can speed up the reduction of carbon dioxide emissions. The European Union has adopted this U.S. innovation and is making it work effectively. Here at home, While the Congress has not yet passed a federal cap-and-trade system for carbon dioxide emissions, there is an effective private sector carbon market that is already up and running. The Chicago Climate Exchange, CCX, is a fledgling market based on the simple premise that reducing carbon emissions is valuable, not just as an idealistic goal, but literally worth money. With leading businesses like Ford, Rolls-Royce, IBM, and Motorola signing on to this experiment, it's clear that some business leaders have seen the need to get a grip on global climate change and are thinking outside the box about how to do it. One goal of the CCX is to figure out how best to run a carbon market so that if and when our government rolls out a national cap-and-trade program, as many expect it eventually will, the kinks will already be worked out. At this point, CCX members join up voluntarily, pledging to reduce their emissions of greenhouse gases. 6 are targeted. Once each member's emissions are converted into tradable credits, the exchange works like any financial market. If participants reduce their emissions below their target, they can sell their carbon credits on the exchange for a profit. If they fail to reduce their emissions, they must buy credits from others. The value of the carbon depends on how many companies are buying it rather than selling it. For now, because more companies are selling emissions credits because they have surpassed their reduction targets, the price of carbon is low. In Europe, though, where a carbon market is much more advanced, it trades at a much higher price. The carbon prices on the European exchanges are higher, precisely because the allowances for carbon emissions are mandated by government. In other parts of the world, there is also movement in this direction. In Canada, the Montreal Commodity Exchange and the Mumbai Commodity Exchange in India, to name two, are in the process of launching carbon trading facilities. These are encouraging developments that move the world closer to the ultimate vision of a closed global carbon market, linking up the capabilities of all exchanges into a single system. Here in the United States, there has been progress at the state level in establishing mandated emissions trading, including the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in the northeastern states, and legislation is pending in California. For now, however, the private CCX initiative is where the real action is taking place. For many companies that have already signed on, participation is a way to gain early experience with this sort of market. It is also a good incentive to embark on emissions reduction projects. For DuPont, one of CCX's founding partners, a key benefit is the chance to shape rules and procedures for the trading system. During its participation, the company has been making changes to reduce its emissions by increasing the energy efficiency of its facilities and decreasing its greenhouse gas emissions from manufacturing. All types of organizations can join the CCX. The members now include NGOs such as World Resources Institute, municipalities such as the City of Oakland, California, and universities such as the University of Oklahoma. The CCX is leading the way toward a future in which reducing greenhouse gases could bring not only environmental rewards, but financial ones too.
How do I describe my sister? She was luminous, charismatic, gutsy, astute, funny, incredibly smart, and kind. When I was a child, despite our 10-year age difference, she was my playmate. She was also my protector. There were only the two of us kids, and we were our own team. Whether we were running through the halls of the Fairfax Hotel or diving into the Caney Fork River in Carthage, Tennessee, she knew me like no one else when I was growing up. We both loved Center Hill Lake near our farm in Carthage. She taught me to water ski on it. We often took canoes out on the river and had lazy conversations while we paddled. She really liked duck hunting and got a kick out of the fact that people thought it was unusual for a young woman to duck hunt. She enjoyed breaking new ground. Later, in her early 20s, Nancy was one of the first two volunteers for the Peace Corps, working for Bill Moyers and Sergeant Shriver to open the Washington office and help get the whole thing started. I was always proud of her instinct to find work that directly improved people's lives. She was also my constant booster, moving from her home in Mississippi during my first campaign for Congress to spend months at a time in the toughest county in the district. I credit her in large part with my victory in that race. She was terrific at convincing people to vote for her little brother. She was ferocious in defending me, tireless in promoting me, and more candid than anyone else could be in taking me to task when I needed it. Nancy possessed a special grace, but also a rebellious streak. Her cigarette smoking was just one example. She started when she was 13 years old and never stopped. She tried to quit, but cigarettes really had a hold on her. The scientists have since learned that the nicotine in tobacco can be more addictive than heroin, and their studies show that kids who start smoking in their early teens or before have by far the hardest time quitting. During the 1960s, even after the Surgeon General's report made it abundantly clear that smoking can cause lung cancer, the tobacco companies were working overtime to encourage Americans not to believe the science, to create doubts about whether there was any real cause for concern. And a lot of people who might otherwise have fully absorbed the terrible truth about smoking and health were tempted to take it less seriously than they should have. After all, if there were still such serious doubts, then maybe the jury was still out. Maybe the science wasn't definitive. So for almost 40 years after the landmark Surgeon General's report linking smoking to lung cancer, emphysema, and other diseases in the United States, more Americans continued to die from smoking-related causes than were killed during World War II. The clever and deceitful approach the tobacco companies used to confuse people about what the science really demonstrated added up to a model for the campaign that many oil and coal companies are using today to confuse people about what the science of global warming is really telling us. They exaggerate minor uncertainties in order to pretend that the big conclusions are not a matter of consensus. To this day, if you ask doctors and scientists to describe in intricate detail the exact process by which smoking cigarettes leads to lung cancer, they'll give you an overall picture and tell you they know for sure that there is a deadly causative link. But if you push them hard enough on some of the minor details, you'll soon reach a point at which they will have to say, well, we don't know exactly how that particular relationship works. Yet the fact that some important details are still to be fully understood in no way changes the reality of the problem. It's cynical and wrong to use such misleading caveats to convince people that the connection between cigarettes and cancer is a big lie. And just as it was immoral for the tobacco companies to use that tactic in the decades following the mid-1960s, it's equally immoral now for the oil and coal companies to do the same thing where global warming is concerned. Nancy was beautiful, vibrant, and strong. But lung cancer proved too cruel an adversary. When I first got news of her initial diagnosis in 1983, I immediately visited the National Institutes of Health and spoke with leading cancer specialists about the particular form of lung cancer Nancy had and tried to learn from them how it could best be treated. Some friends have suggested that that was a defense mechanism and that the policy wonk in me took refuge in facts and data. Truth is, I just wanted to save her. In fact, I did what millions of Americans facing the loss of a loved one do every single day in this country. I scoured medicine for a miracle. Today, thankfully, an increasing number of cancer patients are being cured, although lung cancer remains one of the toughest types to beat. And Nancy's illness struck 20 years ago, when there wasn't the same medical arsenal there is now. The surgeons removed one of Nancy's lungs and part of the other one. She then had to wait for a period of months to see whether that measure had been successful. It turned out not to have been. Believe me, lung cancer is one of the ways you don't want to die. Often, the victim actually drowns from the constant buildup of fluid in the lungs once the pathology overwhelms the body's natural healing processes. The suffering can be unspeakable. I was in the midst of my first campaign for the U.S. Senate on July 11, 1984, when my father called and said Nancy was fading. I rushed back to her bedside. My mother and father were there in the room, along with Tipper, and of course Frank Hunger, Nancy's beloved husband. Her pain had long since reached such agonizing levels that she was getting large doses of morphine and other painkillers, which inevitably affected her level of consciousness. Before I got back to her room, she'd been in what the other family members had described as a haze produced by the painkillers, her eyes glassy and unfocused. But the instant I walked in and Nancy heard my voice, she turned her head toward me and popped out of the fog completely, focusing intensely on my eyes. I'll never forget that moment. It was just us again, a brother and sister who could communicate without words. And I imagine, actually I really don't think I was imagining, but instead was hearing from her quite clearly, a powerful yet silent question. Do you bring hope? I looked into her eyes and said, I love you, Nancy. I knelt by the bed, holding her hand for a long time, and soon she took her last breath and slipped away. I spoke publicly about my sister's death for the very first time when I accepted the Democratic nomination for vice president in 1996, and was surprised that some felt the remarks were mawkish. Nancy played too important a role in my life not to talk about her at a moment when the nation was in the midst of a struggle with the tobacco companies to get them to change their ways and stop convincing young women and men to make the same deadly mistake Nancy had made when she started smoking at 13. I wanted her story to sound an alarm about the perils of tobacco and help put a stop to the way tobacco's apologists were drowning out the sober voices of science. But beyond that, there's no understanding me without understanding Nancy. She was a powerful force in my life when she was alive, and remains so even now. Nancy was a strong, independent woman. I know that no one forced her to keep smoking all those years. But I'm also convinced that had the cigarette industry not glamorized smoking and whitewashed its ravages, my Nancy would be alive today. I wouldn't have to miss her every day of my life. I would still have her smiles and her teasing, her advice and counsel, and hugs from my loving, warm, irreplaceable big sister. I also wish my family had extricated itself from growing tobacco sooner than it did after Nancy's illness. Truthfully, we all were numb during the onslaught of the cancer, and then our attention was focused on getting her well. The implications of continuing to grow a crop on my father's farm that helped produce the cigarettes that had caused her fatal disease seemed a little abstract and a little remote at that point, in the same way that global warming seems remote to many right now. But conversations about shutting down tobacco growing on our farm had begun when she first got sick, and not long after her death, my father decided he would stop growing tobacco altogether. I know from this experience that it sometimes takes time to connect all the dots when accepted habits and behaviors are first found to be harmful. But I also learned that a day of reckoning might come when you very much wish that you had connected the dots more quickly. Now, of course, just as the scientists of 1964 clearly told us that smoking kills people by causing lung cancer and other diseases, the best scientists of the 21st century are telling us ever more urgently that the global warming pollution we're pumping into Earth's atmosphere is harming the planet's climate and putting the future of human civilization at grave risk. And once again, we are taking our time, too much time, in connecting the dots.
The second problem in the way we think about the climate crisis is the wide gulf between what C.P. Snow described as the two cultures. Science has become so specialized in its single-minded pursuit of ever more refined knowledge and narrowing subspecialties that the rest of us have more and more difficulty making sense of their conclusions and translating their wisdom into plain language. Moreover, Since science thrives on uncertainty and politics is paralyzed by it, scientists have a difficult time sounding the alarm bells for politicians, because even when their findings make it clear that we're in grave danger, their first impulse is to replicate the experiment to see if they get the same results. Politicians, on the other hand, often confuse self-interested arguments paid for by lobbyists and planted in the popular press with legitimate, peer-reviewed studies published in reputable scientific journals. For example, the so-called global warming skeptics cite one article more than any other in arguing that global warming is just a myth, a statement of concern during the 1970s that the world might be in danger of entering a new ice age. But the article in which that scientist's comment appeared was published in Newsweek and never appeared in any peer-reviewed journal. Moreover, the scientist who made the statement corrected it shortly thereafter with a clear explanation of why his offhand comment was erroneous. There is a misconception that the scientific community is in a state of disagreement about whether global warming is real, whether human beings are the principal cause, and whether its consequences are so dangerous as to warrant immediate action. In fact, there is virtually no serious disagreement remaining on any of these central points that make up the consensus view of the world scientific community. According to Jim Baker, when he was head of NOAA, the scientific agency responsible for most of the measurements related to global warming, there is a better scientific consensus on this issue than any other, with the possible exception of Newton's law of dynamics. Donald Kennedy, editor-in-chief of Science magazine, summarized this point when he said of the consensus on global warming, "Consensus as strong as the one that is developed around this topic is rare in science." A University of California at San Diego scientist, Dr. Naomi Oreskes, published in Science magazine a massive study of every peer-reviewed science journal article on global warming from the previous 10 years. She and her team selected a large random sample of 928 articles, representing almost 10% of the total, and carefully analyzed how many of the articles agreed or disagreed with the prevailing consensus view. About a quarter of the articles in the sample dealt with aspects of global warming that did not involve any discussion of the central elements of the consensus. Of the three quarters that did address these main points, the percentage that disagreed with the consensus? Zero. Has the disinformation campaign on global warming succeeded? Well, alongside the study of peer-reviewed scientific journal articles that showed 0% in disagreement with the consensus on global warming, another large study was conducted of all the articles on global warming during the previous 14 years in the four newspapers considered by the authors of the study to be the most influential in America: the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, and the Wall Street Journal. They selected a large random sample of almost 18% of the articles. Astonishingly, they found that more than one half gave equal weight to the consensus view on the one hand, and the scientifically discredited view that human beings play no role in global warming on the other. The authors concluded that American news media had been falsely giving the impression that the scientific community was embroiled in a rip-roaring debate on whether or not humans were contributing to global warming. No wonder people are confused. The misconception that there is serious disagreement among scientists about global warming is actually an illusion that has been deliberately fostered by a relatively small but extremely well-funded cadre of special interests, including ExxonMobil and a few other oil, coal, and utilities companies. These companies want to prevent any new policies that would interfere with their current business plans that rely on the massive, unrestrained dumping of global warming pollution into the Earth's atmosphere every hour of every day. One of the internal memos prepared by this group to guide the employees they hired to run their disinformation campaign was discovered by the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Ross Gelbspan. Here was the group's stated objective: to reposition global warming as theory rather than fact. This technique has been used before. The tobacco industry, 40 years ago, reacted to the historic Surgeon General's report linking cigarette smoking to lung cancer and other lung diseases by organizing a similar disinformation campaign. One of their memos, prepared in the 1960s, was recently uncovered during one of the lawsuits against the tobacco companies on behalf of the millions of people who have been killed by their product. It is interesting to read it 40 years later in the context of the ongoing global warming disinformation campaign. Doubt is our product, since it is the best means of competing with the body of fact that exists in the mind of the general public. It is also the means of establishing a controversy. Close quote. Brown and Williamson Tobacco Company Memo, 1960s. One prominent source of disinformation on global warming has been the Bush-Cheney White House. They have attempted to silence scientists working for the government who, like James Hansen of NASA, have tried to warn about the extreme danger we are facing. They have appointed skeptics recommended by oil companies to key positions from which they can prevent action against global warming. As our principal negotiators in international forums, these skeptics can prevent agreement on a worldwide response to global warming. At the beginning of 2001, President Bush hired a lawyer lobbyist named Philip Cooney to be in charge of environmental policy in the White House. For the previous 6 years, Cooney had worked at the American Petroleum Institute and was the person principally in charge of the oil and coal company's campaign to confuse the American people about this issue. Even though Cooney has no scientific training whatsoever, he was empowered by the president to edit and censor the official assessments of global warming from the EPA and other parts of the federal government. In 2005, a White House memo authorized by Cooney was leaked to the New York Times by a hidden whistleblower inside the administration. Cooney had diligently edited out any mention of the dangers global warming poses to the American people. The newspaper's disclosure was embarrassing to the White House, and Cooney, in what has become a rare occurrence in the last few years, resigned. The next day, he went to work for ExxonMobil. A century ago, Upton Sinclair was one of the most respected members of a remarkable group of investigative journalists and authors who uncovered horrendous abuses that had been hidden in the excesses of the Gilded Age and helped to stimulate the reforms of the Progressive Era. Sinclair made a point then that might well be applied to the group of naysayers appointed by the Bush-Cheney administration to be in charge of America's response to global warming. Naysayers like Cooney, who are working to convince Americans that the problem is not real, much less dangerous, and that we're not responsible for it in any way. He said, "It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it." What makes this kind of dishonesty intolerable is that there's so much at stake. On June 21, 2004, 48 Nobel Prize-winning scientists accused President Bush and his administration of distorting science. They wrote, "By ignoring scientific consensus on critical issues such as global climate change, President Bush and his administration are threatening the Earth's future."
The third problem in our way of thinking about global warming is our false belief that we have to choose between a healthy economy and a healthy environment. In 1991, Al Gore was part of a bipartisan group of senators who tried to convince the first Bush administration to go to the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro. In response, the White House organized a conference to communicate the impression that they were behaving responsibly. And as part of their effort, they made a colorful pamphlet about global stewardship to persuade people that they were acting to protect the global environment. One particularly intriguing image depicted the way they saw the balance between the environment and the economy. The illustration is emblematic of a widely held view concerning the fundamental choice that the United States must make between the economy and the environment. The image features an old-fashioned set of scales. On one side are gold bars representing wealth and economic success. On the other side is the entire planet. The implication is that this is not only a choice we have to make, but a difficult one. But in fact, it's a false choice for two reasons. First, without a planet, we won't fully enjoy those gold bars. And second, if we do the right thing, then we are going to create a lot of wealth, jobs, and opportunity. One of the keys to solving the climate crisis involves finding ways to use the powerful force of market capitalism as an ally. And more than anything else, that requires accurate measurements of the real consequences, positive and negative, of all the important economic choices we make. The environmental impact of our economic choices has often been ignored because traditional business accounting has allowed these factors to be labeled externalities and routinely excluded from the balance sheet. It is not surprising that this unwise practice has persisted for as long as it has. These factors are sometimes difficult to put a price tag on, and by simply declaring that these factors are external, it is easy to put them out of sight and out of mind. Now, however, many business leaders are finally recognizing the full effects of their choices and price in such factors as the environment, community impact, and employee longevity by using sophisticated techniques to measure their true value. Part of this strategy involves taking a broader view of how businesses can sustain their profitability over time. These leaders are abandoning their obsessive short-term focus for a longer-term view. This can often make a big difference in evaluating the pros and cons of investments that are likely to pay off after 2 or 3 years. Many such investments are routinely avoided today because the marketplace penalizes any expenditures that hurt short-term profits. But there is also a big change underway in the investment community, led by investors who have become dissatisfied with the short-termism in the financial markets and who want to adopt a more realistic view of how businesses build up and retain their value. These investors are taking the environment and other factors into account when they evaluate an investment. For example, many individual and institutional investors are now deciding that it is prudent to consider the potential impact of their investments on climate change. Whether it is putting money into a savings account at a bank or local credit union, buying stocks, investing in mutual funds for your retirement, or managing your kids' college fund, it matters where your money goes. Considering sustainability issues when investing need not diminish returns. Indeed, some evidence shows that it can enhance them. You can make a contribution to stopping climate change, support global sustainability, and do well financially if you choose your investments wisely. Unfortunately, the false choice between our economy and the environment, which was posed in the Bush administration's pamphlet, affects our policies in harmful ways. One example is auto mileage standards. Japan has cars that are required by law to get more than 45 miles per gallon. Europe is not far behind and has passed new laws designed to surpass Japanese standards. Our friends in Canada and Australia are moving toward higher requirements of more than 30 miles per gallon. Yet the United States is dead last. We're told that we have to protect our automobile companies from competition in places like China, where, it is said, their leaders don't care about the environment. In fact, Chinese emission standards have been raised and already far exceed our own. Ironically, we cannot sell cars made in America to China because we don't meet their environmental standards. In California, the state legislature has taken the initiative to require higher standards for cars sold in California. But the auto companies are suing California to prevent this state law from taking effect, because it would mean that 10 years from now, they would have to manufacture cars for California that are almost as efficient as China is making today. Our outdated environmental standards are based on faulty thinking about the true relationship between the economy and the environment. They are intended in this case to help automobile companies succeed. But as the chart makes clear, it's the companies building more efficient cars that are doing well. The U.S. companies are in deep trouble, and they're still redoubling their efforts to sell large, inefficient gas guzzlers, even though the marketplace is sending the same message that the environment is sending. Luckily, more and more U.S. business executives are beginning to lead us in the right direction. For example, General Electric recently announced a dramatic new initiative on global warming. Jeffrey Immelt, the CEO of GE, explained how the environment and the economy fit together in his vision. He said, "We think green means green. This is a time period where environmental improvement is going to lead toward profitability."
The fourth and final problem in the way some people think about global warming is the dangerous misconception that if it really is as big a threat as the scientists are telling us it is, then maybe we're helpless to do anything about it, so we might as well throw up our hands. An astonishing number of people go straight from denial to despair without pausing on the intermediate step of saying, we can do something about this, and we can. We have everything we need to begin solving the climate crisis, save perhaps political will. But in America, political will is a renewable resource. Each one of us is a cause of global warming, but each of us can become part of the solution in the decisions we make on what we buy, the amount of electricity we use, the cars we drive, and how we live our lives. We can even make choices to bring our individual carbon emissions to zero. Consider, for example, the potential of wind power. Without wind power, we could never have settled the Great Plains. For all the credit we give to railroads, rifles, and horses, it was the windmill that for generations tirelessly pumped underground water to the surface, helping settlers cook, wash, and tend their livestock. Wind has always been a resource waiting to be tapped. A 100-megawatt wind farm, that's 50 300-foot towers carrying 2-megawatt turbines the size of a tractor-trailer truck, can power 24,000 homes. You would have to burn nearly 50,000 tons of coal to provide the same amount of electricity. You have to burn the same amount of coal each year to generate the same amount of energy. Imagine the loads of carbon dioxide that this produces annually. It's true that a modern wind turbine also releases carbon, but only during its manufacture. Once it's up and running, the turbine runs clean. The comparison between coal and wind as energy sources is stark. While coal spews a constant stream of earth-warming carbon, wind power emits none. The market has already decided that wind generation is one of the most mature and cost-effective technologies available to power our future. Utilities all over the country are investing in wind farms. In 2005, General Electric's turbine business doubled. Vestas, the global leader in this area, has made windmills into Denmark's largest export. On some nights along the Danish coast, the winter winds meet all of the local energy needs. In 2008, a quarter of that country's electricity will be pulled from the sky. It's true these windmills are huge, but then so is our appetite for electricity. They alter our skylines, but many find watching their spinning blades peaceful to look at. Every day we continue to fill the air with carbon exhaust, while wind power is right there waiting to be tapped. Two economists at Princeton University, Robert Sokolow and his colleague Stephen Pakala, concluded in a respected study of policies that can help us solve the climate crisis. Humanity already possesses the fundamental scientific, technical, and industrial know-how to solve the carbon and climate problems for the next half century. Consider these statistics based on the Sokolow-Pakala study. U.S. global warming pollution is expected to increase from our current 1.8 gigatons of carbon emissions per year to 2.6 gigatons over the next four decades if we continue business as usual. But we can, in fact, reduce these emissions by more than half in the same period by using six sets of new policies. Together, these changes, all of which are based on already existing affordable technologies, can bring emissions down to a point below 1970s levels. Where are these reductions coming from in these six sets of policies? Here they are. Number one, reduction from more efficient use of electricity in heating and cooling systems, lighting, appliances, and electronic equipment. Number two, reduction from end-use efficiency, meaning that we design buildings and businesses to use far less energy than they currently do. Number three, reduction from increased vehicle efficiency by manufacturing cars that run on less gas and putting more hybrid and fuel cell cars on the roads. Number four, reduction from making other changes in transport efficiency, such as designing cities and towns to have better mass transit systems and building heavy trucks that have greater fuel efficiency. Number five, reduction from increased reliance on renewable technologies that already exist, such as wind and biofuels. And number six, reduction from the capture and storage of excess carbon from power plants and industrial activities. Other countries have already decided to act. The Kyoto Treaty has now been ratified by 132 nations in the developed world. There are only two advanced nations that have not ratified Kyoto, and we are one of them. The other is Australia. Are we going to be left behind as the rest of the world moves forward? Many U.S. cities have ratified the Kyoto Treaty on their own and are implementing policies to reduce global warming pollution below the levels required by the protocol. But what about the rest of us?
As I've traveled around the world giving my slideshow, there are two questions I most often get, particularly in the United States, from people who already know how serious the crisis has become are, one, why do so many people still believe this crisis isn't real? And two, why is this a political issue at all? My response to the first question has been to try to make my slideshow, and now this book, as clear and compelling as I can. As for why so many people still resist what the facts clearly show, I think in part the reason is that the truth about the climate crisis is an inconvenient one that means we're going to have to change the way we live our lives. Most of these changes will turn out to be for the better, things we really should do for other reasons anyway, but they are inconvenient nonetheless. Whether these changes involve something as minor as adjusting the thermostat and using different light bulbs or as major as switching from oil and coal to renewable fuels, they will require effort. But the answer to the first question is also linked to the second question. The truth about global warming is especially inconvenient and unwelcome to some powerful people and companies making enormous sums of money from activities they know full well will have to change dramatically in order to ensure the planet's livability. These people, especially those at a few multinational companies with the most at stake, have been spending many millions of dollars every year in figuring out ways of sowing public confusion about global warming. They've been particularly effective in building a coalition with other groups who agree to support each other's interests, and that coalition has thus far managed to paralyze America's ability to respond to global warming. The Bush-Cheney administration has received strong support from this coalition and seems to be doing everything it can to satisfy their concerns. For example, many scientists working on global warming research throughout the government have been ordered to watch what they say about the climate crisis and instructed not to talk to the news media. More important, all of America's policies related to global warming have been changed to reflect the unscientific view, the administration's view, that global warming is not a problem. Our negotiators in international forums dealing with global warming have been advised to try and stop any movement toward action that would inconvenience oil or coal companies, even if this means disrupting the diplomatic machinery in order to do it. In addition, President Bush appointed the person in charge of the oil company disinformation campaign on global warming to head up all environmental policy in the White House. Even though this lawyer/lobbyist had no scientific training whatsoever, he was empowered by the president to edit and censor all warnings from the EPA and other government agencies about global warming. Political leaders, especially the president, can have a major effect not only on public policy, especially when Congress is controlled by the president's party, is compliant and does whatever the president wants it to, but also on public opinion, especially among those who count themselves followers of the president. Consider this fact. Even as Americans in general have become increasingly concerned about global warming, opinion polls show members of the president's own party becoming less concerned, probably because they're naturally more inclined to give the president the benefit of the doubt. The rationale offered by the so-called global warming skeptics for opposing any action to solve the climate crisis has changed several times over the years. At first, opponents argued that global warming was not occurring at all. They said it was just a myth. A few of them still say that today. But now there's so much undeniable evidence demolishing that assertion that most naysayers have decided they need to change tactics. They now acknowledge that the globe is indeed warming, but in the very next breath, they claim it is just due to natural causes. President Bush himself still tries to take that position, asserting that even though it does seem the world is getting warmer, hey, there's no compelling evidence that human beings are responsible for it. And he seems to be particularly certain that the oil and coal companies that so strongly support him couldn't possibly have anything to do with it. Another related argument used by the deniers is that, yes, global warming does seem to be happening, but it will probably be good for us. Certainly any effort to stop it, they continue, would no doubt be bad for the economy. But the latest, and in my opinion most disgraceful, argument put forth by opponents of change is, yes, it's happening, but there's nothing we can really do about it, so we might as well not even try. This faction favors the continued dumping of global warming pollution into the atmosphere, even though they acknowledge that the crisis it's causing is real and harmful. Their philosophy seems to be eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow our children will inherit the worst of this crisis. It's too inconvenient for us to be bothered. All of these shifting rationales usually rely on the same underlying political tactic: assert that the science is uncertain and that there is grave doubt about the underlying facts. These groups emphasize uncertainty because they know that politics in America can be paralyzed by it. They understand that it's a politician's natural instinct to avoid taking any stand that seems controversial unless and until the voters demand it or conscience absolutely requires it. So if voters and the politicians who represent them can be convinced that scientists themselves disagree on fundamental issues concerning global warming, then the political process can be paralyzed indefinitely. That's exactly what has happened, at least until quite recently, and it's still unclear when the situation will really change. Part of the problem has to do with a long-term structural change in the way America's marketplace of ideas now operates. The one-way nature of our dominant communications medium, television, has combined with the increasing concentration of ownership over the vast majority of media outlets by a smaller and smaller number of large conglomerates that mix entertainment values with journalism to seriously damage the role of objectivity in America's public forum. Today, there are many fewer independent journalists with the freedom and stature to blow the whistle when important facts are consistently being distorted in order to deceive the public. The Internet offers the most hopeful opportunity to restore integrity to the public dialogue, but television is still dominant in shaping that dialogue. The propaganda techniques that emerged with the new film and broadcasting mass media of the 20th century prefigured the widespread use of related techniques for mass advertising and for political persuasion. And now, corporate lobbying efforts to influence and control public policy have been stepped up dramatically, which in turn is leading to the widespread and often cynical use of these same mass persuasion techniques to condition the public's thinking about important issues, lest they begin to support solutions that will be inconvenient and expensive for particular industries. One of the persistent techniques in the campaign to stop action against the climate crisis has been to repeatedly and persistently accuse the scientists trying to warn us about the crisis of being dishonest, greedy, and untrustworthy, and of misrepresenting scientific facts in order to somehow beef up their research grants. These charges are insulting and ludicrous, but they've been repeated often enough and loudly enough through so many media megaphones that many people do now wonder if the charges are true. And that is particularly ironic, given that so many of the skeptics actually do receive funding and support from self-interested groups financed by corporations desperate to stop any action against global warming. Incredibly, the public has been hearing the discredited views of these skeptics as much as, or more than they have heard the consensus view of the global scientific community. That disgraceful fact is a notable stain on the record of America's modern news media, and many leaders of journalism are belatedly taking steps to correct it. But it is far from clear that the news media will be able to sustain a higher commitment to objectivity in the face of the intense pressures that increasingly erode it and render it shockingly vulnerable to this kind of organized propaganda. We've lost a lot of time that could have been spent solving the crisis because the opponents of action have thus far successfully politicized the issue in the minds of many Americans. We can't afford inaction any longer, and frankly, there's just no excuse for it. We all want the same thing, for our children and the generations after them to inherit a clean and beautiful planet capable of supporting a healthy human civilization. That goal should transcend politics. Yes, the science is ongoing and always evolving, but there's already enough data, enough damage to know without question that we're in trouble. This isn't an ideological debate with two sides, pro and con. There's only one Earth, and all of us who live on it share a common future. Right now, we're facing a planetary emergency, and it's time for action, not for more phony controversies designed to ensure political paralysis.
So here's what you personally can do to help solve the climate crisis. When considering a problem as vast as global warming, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and powerless, skeptical that individual efforts can really have an impact. But we need to resist that response, because this crisis will get resolved only if we as individuals take responsibility for it. By educating ourselves and others, by doing our part to minimize our use and waste of resources, by becoming more politically active and demanding change, in these ways and many others, each of us can make a difference. Here are some very practical steps anyone can take to reduce the stress our high-tech lives exert on the natural world. As we incorporate these suggestions into our lives, we may find that not only are we contributing to a global solution, we are also making our lives better. In some cases, the returns are quantifiable. Using less electricity and fuel, for example, saves money. Further, more walking and biking will improve our health. Diets of locally grown produce bring enhanced taste and nutrition. Breathing cleaner air is energizing and healing, and creating a world of restored natural balance ensures a future for our children and grandchildren. One way to begin making a difference is to learn how the way we live our lives impacts our global environment. All of us contribute to climate change through the daily choices we make, from the energy we use at home to the cars and other vehicles we drive, from the products and services we consume to the trail of waste we leave behind. The average American is responsible for about 15,000 pounds of carbon dioxide emissions each year. This per capita number is greater than that of any other industrialized country. In fact, the United States, a country with 5% of the world's people, produces nearly 25% of the world's total greenhouse gas emissions. To calculate your impact on the climate in terms of the total amount of greenhouse gases you produce, visit www.climatecrisis.net. There, with the help of an interactive energy meter, you can calculate what your individual impact, your carbon footprint, currently is. This tool will also help you evaluate which areas of your life produce the most emissions. Armed with this information, you can begin to take effective action and work toward living a carbon-neutral life. Reduce emissions from your home energy use. For most Americans, the easiest and most immediate opportunities to reduce emissions can be found right in their own homes. Most greenhouse gas emissions that originate in the home are a product of the fossil fuels burned to generate electricity and heat. Many things can be done to reduce these emissions. With an action as simple as changing a few light bulbs, you can take the first important step toward reducing your energy consumption. Saving energy is not only a good thing to do for the climate crisis, it can also translate to real cost savings. Choosing energy-efficient alternatives for the home can help families cut their energy bills by as much as one-third, while reducing greenhouse gas emissions by a similar amount. While many actions can be taken at little or no cost, others may require a small investment up front that will pay for itself in reduced energy bills. Here are some specific ways you can conserve energy in your home. Choose energy-efficient lighting. Lighting accounts for one-fifth of all the electricity consumed in the United States. One of the easiest and most cost-effective ways to reduce your energy use, energy costs, and greenhouse gas emissions is to replace the regular incandescent light bulbs in your home with super-efficient compact fluorescent lights, CFLs. CFLs fit right into most regular household fixtures and give off the same warm light, but they are much more energy efficient. The conventional incandescent bulbs most consumers use in their homes are highly energy inefficient. Only 10% of the energy they consume actually generates illumination, while 90% of it is lost in the form of heat. While CFL bulbs cost more up front, they last up to 10,000 hours, 10 times longer than incandescent bulbs, and use 66% less energy. If every household in the United States substituted even one conventional light bulb with a CFL bulb, it would have the same effect on pollution levels as removing a million cars from the nation's roads. To purchase CFLs online, visit www.efi.org or www.nolico.com/saveenergy/. Choose energy-efficient appliances when making new purchases. One of the most significant opportunities consumers have to improve home energy efficiency is in the selection of new major appliances such as air conditioners, furnaces, water heaters, and refrigerators. Choosing models that have been designed to use energy efficiently will save you money over time and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Energy Star program website provides useful information to help with consumer decisions. For information about the newest energy-efficient appliances, visit www.energystar.gov/products. Properly operate and maintain your appliances. While buying energy-efficient appliances is a good first step in helping to reduce your long-term greenhouse gas emissions, you can also improve the energy efficiency of older appliances. For example, refrigerators should not be placed next to heat sources such as ovens, dishwashers, and heaters that force them to overwork in order to maintain cool temperatures. A refrigerator's condenser coils should be kept dust-free to ensure unblocked airflow through the unit's heat exchanger. Any appliance's filters should be regularly cleaned or changed. Another energy-saving tip. Instead of running frequent partial loads in your dishwasher or washing machine, save energy by running only full loads. When you have time, wash your dishes by hand and use a clothesline to dry your clothes instead of the dryer. The American Council for an Energy-Efficient Economy has a checklist available to guide home energy savings, including how to operate appliances. It also has an extensive FAQ section and offers a book you can order for a fuller explanation. Visit acee.org/consumerguide/chklst.htm. For additional tips, visit Earth